Blog Talk Radio.
Have you ever been in a dark place, unhappy, feeling hopeless, and there didn't seem to be any way out? Imagine being totally blind and obese and finally discovering a way to get past the pain and suffering and thrive. So what's your excuse? Stay tuned. Welcome to the Healthy Baby Boomers Network Blog Talk Radio Show. I am your host, Dr. Erica Goodstone, licensed mental health counselor, spiritual relationship healer, somatic body psychotherapist, and health and wellness coach, helping men and women heal their bodies and their relationships through love. Author of the book Love Me, Touch Me, Heal Me, and the romantic novel Love in the Blizzard of Life, and creator of Healing Through Love seminars, Love Me, Touch Me, Heal Me relationship system, and the upcoming 30-day love challenge. This show is all about living your dreams, fulfilling your life purpose, and creating and sustaining love and health and total well-being for the rest of your life, no matter what age you are right now. In every episode, I speak with vibrant, exciting, and positive men and women who are proving that life can and often does get better and better as we reach our 40s, 50s, 60s, and beyond. Maxwell Ivey is a totally blind business owner, blogger, podcaster, and he has coached and twice self-published books. His primary business is helping people sell new and used amusement equipment, which began after the early death of his father and the closure of his family's small traveling carnival. Maxwell's first book, Leading You Out of the Darkness into the Light, tells his story. He also managed to lose 250 pounds after having gastric surgery and finally eating healthier, exercising regularly, drinking more water, quitting caffeine, eating smaller portions, taking supplements, and adding prayer, meditation, and a new attitude to his life. Living a healthier lifestyle is the focus of his second book, It's Not the Cookie, It's the Bag, and I'd love to hear about that one. Both of his books are now available on Amazon. So I'm delighted to welcome this courageous and influential man, Maxwell Ivey.
Well, hi there, Dr. Erica. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. I'm so glad that we're connecting, and I can't wait to hear about your story. So tell us about your story. When did the blindness happen? And were you blind at birth, or did it happen later on? What was your earlier life like in your family's traveling carnival? That alone is fascinating. And then what happened after your father died? So tell us the story.
Okay. I have retinitis pigmentosa. It's a degenerative hereditary disease that attacks the retina. I had perfect vision until I was 4 or 5 years old, and the family noticed that I was falling down and running into stuff more than the rest of the kids, so they had me tested and found out that I had this. I lost vision gradually up until I was 12 or 13 years old, and then I had a big drop-off in vision. It stayed pretty constant from then until I was in college, and then I lost more vision again down to what I have now, which is considered light perception. But I have very little actual vision, and I do most everything with either speech or tactile or by asking somebody who can see, so I consider myself totally blind. Growing up in the family carnival, I think actually made things a lot easier because my mom came from a family of 6 brothers and sisters. There was lots of cousins, aunts and uncles, and most all of them were in the business in one way or another. We played together, looked after each other. Sometimes they would change the rules of the game so I could play with them. And when our parents traveled during the school year, we would stay with other relatives until school was out, and then when school was out, we would follow them around to whatever town they were going to. We would still play together, but we'd also play with some of the kids from town. I would say when I was probably 5 or 6, though, my grandmother realized that the best thing to do with me was to put me to work, because if I was doing something with the grown-ups, the odds are I couldn't get in trouble and I couldn't end up getting hurt doing something. So at, 5 or 6 years old, my grandmother had me bagging up the popcorn and putting butter on it and putting the syrup on the snow cones. And anytime she had a dirty job that needed to be done, she'd usually find me. And I like to tell people now, you grow up with a woman like my grandmother, Nanny Wagner, you don't ever tell her you're bored, because if you tell her you don't have nothing to do, she will find you something to do. And it would never be nothing you really wanted to be doing. I spent many hours tearing up used ride tickets, sorting and wrapping change, washing belly cloth canvas, scrubbing out cotton candy pans. Like I say, you didn't want to tell that woman you didn't have nothing to do, because you were not going to like her answer at all.
But what's good about that is that, Max, what's good about that is that you learned to do some of those nitty-gritty details, like nothing is above you. You're not better than that.
Well, that's true. That's one of the things that, that people who operate any kind of a small business will learn, but people who grow up in a carnival or a circus or some sort of entertainment business like I did, you learn right away that nobody really cares anything about you or your excuses or what happened during the week. All they care about is, are you open on Thursday or Friday night? Are the rides operating? Can they buy a bag of cotton candy or a funnel cake or not? And pretty much anything you have to do short of breaking the law between Sunday night and Thursday when you have to be open again, you pretty much will do it, because, like I say, they don't care. They don't want your excuses. They just want you to be open. It really does teach you about doing the hard, dirty jobs, about finding interesting solutions to problems that come up while you're in the middle of trying to do something else. And I like to say one thing it taught me is that life does not award style points. This ain't the Olympics, and you also don't get bonus points for making things more difficult on yourself. So growing up in the carnival taught me a lot of valuable lessons. A couple years ago, I did an interview with David Ray from a show called Join Up Dots, and he said, Max, I've thought about your life as a carny, and he said, I think that in 10 or 15 years of you running your own or helping your family run your own carnival, that you accumulated at least one, if not two, PhDs in hustle and muscle. And when he first told me that, I was like, you don't know what you're talking about. And the more I thought about it, I was like, that's not only right, but I'm going to steal that, because it is so true. It is so true. You learn about doing the dirty jobs. You learn about just finding a way and not allowing yourself to fail is what you learn about. So I went away to college and got a degree in political science from Texas A&M at Corpus Christi, which does me absolutely no good other than it allows me to say that I graduated college and got a degree, which is something that only a couple other people in my extended family can say. So at least I accomplished it. I don't really use it much other than, there are, again, if you've taught yourself how to get there and how to accomplish a goal that's set up for yourself, then yeah, my degree has value. But if I had to go look for a job right now, it wouldn't do me much good. So thankfully I work for myself and I get to write blogs and do videos and do interviews with people like you and share my story. So after college, I returned back to the family and went to work helping them book events, and I also operated two or three kids' games and was working hard to try to develop the carnival until my dad died 12 years ago in January. After he died, me and my two brothers were able to keep the show going for about 3 years before the insurance expenses caught up with us, and we realized that we hadn't learned enough from him before he left us in order to run the business by ourselves. It wasn't an easy lesson to take, but we did take it. At first, we went from having a carnival, and then we went from having a couple of rides and booking with my uncle's carnival. And then eventually all we had was a food trailer booked with my uncle's carnival or with other carnivals. And, you know, I had spent lots of time with my dad. We would spend hours on the road together. Of course, he was doing the driving. I was just doing the riding in there to do heavy lifting. But we would spend two, three, 4 days a week moving the trailers from one town to the next. And we spent a lot of time together talking about life, and I've learned a lot from him. So when he died, I did go into a bit of a depression. I had never been what you call healthy. Yeah, I lost my best friend, my business partner, my mentor, my hero. I lost all of them in one person at one time. And I'd never been healthy to begin with, so I started putting on more weight. When we ended up having to close the carnival and go to work with my uncle, well, we had competed very bitterly with my uncle and his family for event dates. And you know what Jeff Foxworthy says, you can't really have a good fight until you can bring the in-laws in. Well, when I say we competed with them, I mean, I'm not talking about we would each call up the same committee and make a pitch. I'm talking about we would talk about each other behind the back. You know, we would more than once, one of my family members has told the committee that we weren't going to show up, or that my father was sick, or that, you know, it's just all sorts of stuff that you would think only happens in the movies kind of stuff. We really wanted to beat each other bad. So on top of losing him, I also had to go, you know, like, what, we have to lose to these people? That's just wrong. So, but we did hook up with my uncle's carnival. We were over there for a few seasons, and eventually it got to the point where the one kid's game that I still owned wasn't making any money. I had been wanting to start working on the Midway Marketplace. That's my equipment site that you mentioned earlier. I had been wanting to work on it full time, but the family kept saying, Max, you know, you can still make a living out here. Why do you want to just quit and go home? And I'm like, I'm not still making a living out here because y'all are having to take money out of the food trailer and put to buy stock for my game. So I eventually convinced them. Also at this same time, I had a health emergency. I had almost been thrown out of a motel in Port Lavaca for peeing on their beds. And it turned out that I had high blood pressure, high cholesterol, gout, and borderline diabetic. And he told me if I didn't go home, I should go home and get with a good doctor, because if I didn't start changing my health, I wouldn't be around much longer. So I went home and found a good doctor. And the first thing she did was suggest that I might have sleep apnea. And I got a sleep study, and sure enough, I not only had it, but a very severe case that they said I probably had since I was a teenager. And they said that was the reason for my wetting the bed, that I was, the apnea was so bad that my body was shutting down during sleep, and I was voiding my bladder. So just think, I have been very close to one of those, you know, sudden deaths that happens in the middle of the night to people who have apnea. People who either don't know they have it or won't admit that they have it. And I'm one of these people. I tell every woman, if your husband snores, get his butt checked out. Because, you know, I say that to women because generally the men are the ones who get it. And there are just so many bad side effects to not getting quality sleep. And, you know, not just high blood pressure and increased risk for stroke, but there's impotence, there's lack of interest. Loss of joy in things that used to bring you pleasure. I mean, just think if you no longer wanted to go fishing or hunting because you weren't getting sleep at night. Nobody would do that. If they knew it, I mean, nobody would do that. And then, you know, you also have falling asleep during normal activities. There's just so many negatives to not getting quality sleep and rest. And in my case, after I started getting better rest, I started thinking, you know, Max, you can do more than be a carny. You know, you can even do more than be an equipment broker. So, you know, I probably wouldn't have thought I could create my own website if I had had to before I started the road towards good health by like I say, getting the apnea diagnosed and then treating it with a CPAP machine. And about, let's see, this is December, so October of 12, a little over 4 years ago, I had gastric surgery. I didn't want to have it.
And what? What led to it?
Well, I had been trying to lose weight on my own and with my doctor's advice for about 18 months at that point. So we're going back to 2010. And she said, Max, I realize that you're not making the progress you would like to. Would you at least go to a seminar and listen to what they have to say about having a surgery? And I said, you know, I don't believe in the surgery. I don't think my dad would have believed in the surgery, but I'll go to the seminar because, you know, you've been right most of the time up till now. So I went and listened, and I found out a couple of really important things. First, I found out that only about 50% of the people who have a procedure will lose 80 to 90% of the weight that they need to lose to be healthy. So that right there tells me it's not a quick fix. It's not a guarantee. It's just a tool that you have to use in combination with making a lot of changes in your life. And I'm one of these people, I'm not as scared of hard work. I'm as scared of stuff that looks too easy. I'm very skeptical that way. You know, I'm one of these people, I grew up with the old mantra, if it sounds too good to be true, it is. And that's kind of how I felt about having a surgery. But, you know, once they told me, hey, Max, you're going to have to work hard. You're going to have to change your life, and you're going to have to do stuff that you don't do now for the rest of your life if you have this surgery. So I was convinced, and I had decided I would have the surgery. The other thing that really helped was when I talked to the person who would be my surgeon, Dr. Terry Scarborough, he said, you know, Max, We have a different approach than most of the clinics you see advertised on TV. He said, here, this is a family thing, and to us, once you're a patient at TLC, Texas Laparoscopic Consultant, I have to mention them because they're kind of like family to me, but they said, once you're one of our patients, you're one of our patients for life. We don't care where you go, what you do, you're ours once you have the surgery, once you become a patient. You know, that was the other thing, is not only would I have to invest from now on, but they would be there too. And that made a lot of difference. As you know for sure, you have to have those support networks. You have to feel like there are people who are going to be there with you along the way, or you can't get there.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah, so what was it like? How was it after the surgery? Did it make a big change in your body right away? Tell us about that.
No, it didn't make a big change right away. After the surgery, those first 2 days are hard because you're coming off of a ventilator, you're having to get your breath back, and anything that causes you to cough or laugh makes you hurt all over. You know, they want to get you back up on your feet right away, and you don't feel like getting back up on your feet. So that's the other thing. And, you know, then you've got 2 weeks of eating really nasty not really quite solid food for a couple of weeks. You know, you eat, I'm convinced whoever came up with the idea of soft scrambled eggs is obviously got something wrong with them at a deep emotional level, you know. having to drink broth, you know, the stuff, you know, that you usually would put in other foods to make, you know, to make them taste right. That's nasty. I think about the best thing I had was sugar-free Jell-O, but even that isn't good after you've eaten it a few days in a row. So, but, you know, I had lost 81 pounds prior to the surgery. It took 6 months from the time I decided to have it until the time I had it. So I lost 81 pounds. It took me a year and a half, almost 2 years, from the surgery to get down to 256 pounds, which was another 170 that I lost.
Wow.
So even with the surgery, even, you know, learning all the stuff they taught us in those classes and changing your diet, it still takes a while to get to that weight. I think the real difference, though, is that the smaller stomach and intestine capacity that you have after a procedure makes it easier to keep doing what you have to do and easier to stay there once you get there. Now, I will tell people this. My book may say easy to follow guide to weight loss success, but that's something my editor put on there. I'm one of these people, I don't believe anything having to do with weight is easy. Even if you know exactly everything you're supposed to do every day, people are human, and they will have days where they don't want to follow their regimen. I have days where I don't want to or where circumstances don't allow me to. And in those cases, you just have to get up and get back to what you did day before yesterday, do that again tomorrow. So I tell people
I'd
that
like to
weight
add
loss
something.
Is...
Yeah, I had a
yes.
client who had the bypass surgery and used to love going to Dunkin' Donuts and having 3 donuts or 6 donuts. And he was so depressed afterwards because he do that anymore. You know, so have you had any of that where there's something you crave and you can't have it anymore?
You know, there isn't really anything that I crave, but you know, that's one of the positive side effects of the surgery. They say that that a lot of people after the surgery have lost some of the cravings for some of the foods that have been real problem areas for them. And it sounds to me like maybe his thing with the donuts was more physical than an emotional craving for it. Like, you know, he's used to doing something every day.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just a thought. You're the doctor. I do this stuff all from my personal experience rather than from any degree, but that's just what it sounds like to me right off the top there.
Max, what it sounds like is you were prepared for it because you were already starting to eat better and exercise. You were starting to do those things before you took the surgery.
That's true. And that's one of the big things about the surgery. You know, since insurance will pay for it, we have all these clinics, a bunch of new ones even, most anywhere you live, that are offering the surgeries. And they offer the surgery as if it's a one and done or a one-off, as they would say in the UK. And it isn't. You have to prepare yourself mentally and emotionally before you have it, and you have to be invested. Otherwise, it won't work. I mean, there are countless celebrities who've had some of these procedures, and they've either not lost weight or they've lost it and gained it back, or even worse, they lost it and gained even more back than they lost. So there are ways you can cheat.
Right.
You know, if you continue to eat beyond what you know is good for you, your stomach will stretch back out again. And it's funny how pliable the stomach is as far as stretching to accommodate what we will put into it, even if we know better.
That's really valuable information, because most of us think of the bypass surgery as this quick fix. That you're just going to get the surgery and it's going to be all better and you're going to lose 100 pounds just like that.
Yeah, that is the perception. It does a disservice to the people in the industry that do understand that, you know, it doesn't matter what tools you're using. It still comes down to can you maintain a particular way of life from now on? And, you know, most people, even myself, you know, it's hard to say you're going to do anything from now on and do it exactly the same way every day for the rest of your life. Those are hard things for people to grab hold of. We just don't like routine to that point. And when we're forced into a routine, we're even worse at accepting it.
That's for sure. That's why Alcoholics Anonymous always says one day at a time.
And it is so true, one day at a time. I like to tell people that weight is kind of like a video game. You can't win But if you lose today, you just press that reset button and try again tomorrow.
Wow. That's great.
Because you can't win. You know, those video games, you're never getting out. And that's the thing. A lot of people feel, you know, you were talking about the surgery being a quick fix. The other thing people have trouble with is a lot of them think that they're going to get to a point where they're going to be at a given weight or a given size, and then they can quit, that they won't have to work at it anymore. And that's another one that's hard to get past.
Mm. So tell us about your coaching program. You do something, big dreams, start with small steps.
Well, what I do is help people first to get down to what their big goal or dream really is. And what I mean there is, so many people have goals that fit with what their parents taught them or what their neighbors are doing or what they see on social media or the TV news. So first you just have to get them to work down to the level where you get it, what's really going to bring them joy. Then you assist them in coming up with the steps and resources that they'll have to take in order to get to that goal. And then you're there to help hold them accountable until they either achieve the goal or until they've been working at it so long that they no longer need your help to continue moving forward to completion. So that's my approach as far as the goals and the, you know, big dreams start with small steps, because that's how I've done it. I never figured on having two websites or being a coach or being somebody they would call an inspiration. All I wanted to do was help people sell amusement equipment so I could make a living and support my family. You know, I didn't know I would be a webmaster, but I did. I didn't know I'd record videos, but I did. And a lot of this, it all goes back to just taking one small step. At first, I filed for my first domain name September 29th of 2007. At the time, I didn't even have the first clue how I would build a website, but, you know, I knew I had to do something. So you start with the first smallest things you can do to accomplish a goal. And a lot of
That was the next question I wanted to ask you about. How did you do this being blind? You're not able to see. So how could you create a website and learn how to code and create a blog and the videos and audios or whatever else you've done?
Well, I think a lot of it has to do with not ever worrying about what I didn't know. I mean, there was a lot of curiosity involved. There was also the knowledge that if I didn't do it or figure out how to do it, it wasn't getting done. Because when you're first starting out, especially, well, at least for me, you either don't have the money to hire people, or if you do have the money to hire them, it's hard to trust somebody with your new project and say, well, here's what I want it to look like. You go build it. And that's hard to do. It takes a lot of trust, especially in the beginning. So I really didn't have a choice.
Not just trust. They don't do it. A lot of times they just don't do it the way you want it. It's not, you know, you go through a lot of frustration.
That's true. It's not just trust. It's also, do they get your vision of what you want to have happen on your website or your blog or whatever. So you're right. It's not just trust, it's vision. But, you know, for example, with the website, I knew that I needed to learn how to run the website. Now, for a long time, even back then, they had these programs that were called WYSIWYG, or what you see is what you get. So basically anybody that could see could create a website by moving stuff around the screen. And when it got to where you liked it, then you would tell the program to stop there, and you would upload it to your website. Well, when you're blind and you can't see the screen, you don't have that choice. So what I had to do was I had to create my website one line of HTML code at a time. And I honestly believe I've written probably 1 million, if not 2 million lines of code before I switched to WordPress and started letting WordPress do a lot of the work for me. And that was in 2012, I switched to WordPress. But before then, if it happened on my website, it was me doing it. And, you know, I did, you know, there again, if you, I went to what they call the, well, at first I asked a bunch of stupid questions on forums and email lists about how to do stuff, and somebody finally said, you know, these are really basic questions. Why don't you go to the W3C.org online tutorial system? And so I went over there, and I basically went one page at a time. First I learned how to create a home page, and then how to create a link, and then how to embed a photo, and then how to make a photo link. And I just did one thing at a time. And most of the stuff worked, except for my choices in colors. With creating a website, you can either choose colors by name or by what's called hexadecimal numbers, which means each color has a number assigned to it. Well, I had no way of knowing what colors went with what numbers, so I just told it to go with the basic colors. So I chose yellow for my background because I remembered that yellow used to look good on the carnival games for displaying toys. I went with blue for the words and red for the links. Well, I would find out later that the yellow was an ice screaming yellow. That was the word actually used by people who visited the page. The blue was a brick. The blue was a dark navy, and the red was a brick red. And I'm told this page, especially the home page with the pictures on it, was so bright that Ray Charles and Stevie Wonder could have had an argument over it. I mean, it was gaudy. It was gaudy. But, you know, I would continue to learn more each time I would mess with the website. But the thing I remind myself of, and I remind anybody who asks me about this, and I actually still keep some screenshots of the old website just to remind me, is that this website it wasn't perfect. It wasn't even close. But because I didn't worry about the shortcomings of the website and just focused on making the contacts and getting the listings and selling equipment, I sold rides, a couple of pretty expensive rides using that website that most webmasters would have nightmares over, because I just focused on. You just shared
something really valuable for our listeners, that so many people I know are more concerned with doing it perfectly, whatever they're doing. The text has to be perfect. The email list, you have to do it right, and you have to do drips, and you have to do all these things before they've done anything.
We were talking about that before the show about your site as well. Everybody suffers from this perfectionism thing, and it's hard to fight against it. But yeah, you have to just accept that this is as good as it's going to get right now, and focus on creating the content, telling people about the content, pitching your services, or you know, pitching yourself for public appearances or radio shows, or just introducing yourself to other people and say, hey, go look at my website, or you know. So there's all those things. Perfectionism is one of the biggest dream killers going, because so many people will get trapped and they'll work on a website for 6 months and still not like it enough to start telling people they have a website. You know, they're.
I had an experience similar to yours. I created my own ebooks. I made them into Kindle books, and I was in a book group, and a couple of people told me that the images were horrible, and someone else told me that the text was not good. So then I got those things fixed. But if I hadn't put it out there, I wouldn't have known. I could have waited and never did it. But people will tell you, you'll get the feedback, and then you can fix it.
Yep. Yeah, it's a little harder with ebooks, but yeah, it works with just about anything. And you know, just way too. I recently did a virtual summit where my title for my talk was "Just Press Send," because I firmly believe that if more people would just press publish, press send, press upload, whatever the button is to get your stuff out there, that people would make a whole lot more progress. They'd be a lot more successful and probably a lot happier. That's my opinion, at least.
Well, sometimes you press send too soon. I just did that this week. I have an upcoming summit, a virtual summit, that is going to be happening in March. I didn't even create the page yet, but I created an email that was going to be on the autoresponder list and I made a mistake of putting it on the list, and I forgot that it goes out immediately. So people got it before the site's even ready. So sometimes you press too soon, but I don't worry about it anymore. If someone's upset, you just explain.
Yeah, but then you'll find, with something like that, though, you find out how many people on your list are actually opening and reading your emails.
Right.
You know,
there's
good in everything if you look. There's good in everything if you look for it. So, you know, you find out who's actually reading your emails, and you also find out who's a good enough follower or friend of yours online to tell you, hey, you just messed up, you know? Because I'll tell you, there are a lot of people who would get that email, and they might not even notice that you did something that wasn't right, or if they notice, they might not tell you about it. I've been surprised by that. There's a lot of people, they're afraid to reach out to you and point out a mistake, and I don't know why that is, because I'm always making mistakes, and I encourage people to help me out when I make them, or even when I don't know I made them. So, but I'll tell you, a lot of people would post that, and nobody would let them know it was even wrong.
That's funny. That's true. I appreciate when people tell me something's not working right. It helps, because then you can fix it. You can do something.
Yeah.
So tell us about your radio show. That's the other thing that I'd love to hear about. What's your it's a great title.
Right. Well, I like the title. I started this about 3 months or so ago with my friend and co-host Frederick Bai, and he basically is my co-host because I'm one of these in the moment kind of people. If I'm having a conversation with somebody, I don't have enough space left in my brain to worry about whether or not the machine is recording or we're online or offline. So the only way I could do the show was to have somebody who could worry about the technical stuff, like creating the show page and sending out the email and all that good stuff that you go through every week. And so about 3 months ago, I met him online. He was looking for some people to co-host or start hosting their shows on his website. And we had known each other from a couple of previous interviews where there was, you know, like three or four people on the interview at the same time. And so he suggested it, and I said, well, look, if you're going to be the co-host and handle the technical stuff, I would love to do it. And the show is called What's Your Excuse? Because so many people have said, if Max can do it, then what is my excuse? And it's about transformation. It's about how people become the person that they end up becoming. And we like to have guests on who will talk about the setbacks and the failures and the bad days, as well as how they got to be the successful person they are now, and anything that they can share with our listeners that will help them to overcome whatever challenges they have in their lives at that moment. And our goal is, by the end of the show, for the listeners to say, well, if he or she can do it, then what is my excuse? And so that's what's my excuse. And it's, you know, it's 3 months old, which means it's old enough that I didn't realize this until I started working with Frederick, but apparently there's a stat that says only 1 in 9 shows make it past 8 episodes. So the fact that we're 3 months and still go, I was shocked by that. But yeah, like only 1 in 9 shows make it past 8 episodes. And I told him, I said, I think I understand that. That's the point where it stops being fun and starts being work. I think.
Wow.
That's just my guess.
Absolutely. And
so,
also, I think a million people are going to come to the first one, you know, and it builds over time.
Yeah, and that's why I tell people, if you get an opportunity to be a guest on a new show, take it, because every time from then on, every time that person does a show, they're going to drain traffic, and some of those people who watch the latest episode are going to go back and watch the first episode or the first few episodes. And so I enjoy doing a show that's brand new or that's just getting started. I also find that in the early days, it's generally people that are connected with or loyal to the host that are following the show, and I find they're much more motivated to share the episodes, which means that the smaller audience, I often get more visits to my website and more reaction out of a show that's in its first few months than I do out of a show that claims to have 50 or 100,000 listeners. And that's all because of the loyalty of the people that are listening.
Wow, that's very interesting. So before I forget, how can people find this radio show? Tell us the link to your website, to the show.
Okay, well, the link to my website is theblindblogger.net, and I generally post a blog post about each episode there, so there'll be a link to the current show. There'll also be a link to the show just before it. They can also go over to my friend and co-host site, frederickby.com, which is FREDERICBYE.com. And over there, they can not only find the link to my show, but also the link to his show about creative magic. And Mara Sweeney's show, Mara for You, is also syndicated there. So, and who knows who else will join between now and the time people are hearing this episode. So there's some good shows over there that people can check out. Of course, they should start with mine. And on Twitter, I'm at Maxwell Ivy. And on YouTube, if they want to watch my videos, it's youtube.com/Maxwell Ivy.
Max, it's been absolutely wonderful speaking with you. And our time is running out, but is there one message you could leave our listeners with out of all you've been saying?
I would say the one thing I would tell people, and it's the one thing I try to do every day, and that is I do what I can as well as I can today, and then try to do it better or do more of it tomorrow.
Wow. That is beautiful. So thank you so much for sharing your time with me today.
Well, thank you so much for having me, and also for understanding my little problem with the scheduling and rescheduling and, you know, switching all your stuff around so you could have me on. I really appreciate it. I've enjoyed talking with you. You got a great show, and I'm looking forward to hearing some of the comments from your listeners.
Thank you so much. So I'm your host, Dr. Erica Goodstone, saying goodbye for now. Please visit my website, HealthyBabyBoomersNetwork.com, to get your free report, How to Live to 100 and Beyond, and if you're ready to create lasting love, check out the link to the 30-Day Love Challenge, which will be coming up soon. I look forward to speaking to you again soon.